This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. A mayor's race in New Haven comes down to the wire. A verdict comes down in the East Haven police discrimination case and new allegations of sexual violence on a college campus. Those are just a few of the stories we'll cover today in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. With a lot of news coming out of the New Haven area this week, we've brought our show to our Elm City studios. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. I'm joined, as always, on Wednesdays by Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. But, Colin, you and I are separated today. I'm missing you. I'm down in New Haven and you're up in Hartford. How are you doing today?
I feel the same sense of separation, but I feel we are umbilically linked through the miracle of modern technology.
And there's a lot of technology at work here making this happen today. We'll be talking with Colin throughout the course of the show, as well as Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Always good to see you, Paul.
Nice to see you, John.
Susan Campbell is here. She's Communications and Development Director at the Partnership for Strong Communities. Of course, a longtime friend of our show and our East Haven correspondent. And this will come in handy later on. Susan, good to see you.
Good to see you.
And Evan Lips is here. He's a reporter for the New Haven Register who's been covering this East Haven story. Evan, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, you're welcome, John.
So we want to start with this story about the East Haven verdict. David Carey and Dennis Spaulding found guilty in this case. They faced up to 20 years in prison. Maybe you can just, Evan, take us through again what exactly it is they were charged with. What have they been convicted of?
Well, it's funny. When I woke up this morning, I decided to bring this whole, basically this is the indictment that came down in 2012. And I was reading it over again and looking it over. And basically this was a racial profiling case from beginning to end, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know. And what they are convicted of is conspiring, basically, to profile and pull over Latino drivers in East Haven. And it's a tough case to prove. That's pretty much the meat of it. And then you have other ones like David Carey altering a police report and the arrest of a New Haven priest. And you had Dennis Spaulding using excessive force, and all of these instances, they were convicted, and it was quite a shocking day in that courtroom.
It was a shocking day in the courtroom. Maybe you could just describe the scene in the courtroom, because obviously there's been so much emotion, so much national attention around this case. What was it like there?
It was I felt a knot in my stomach right before they had the foreman deliver the results and read the verdict. I didn't know. Nobody really had any clue what was going to happen. You had two officers of the law on trial. Was that going to affect the outcome? I guess you could say it didn't. And when they started reading them off, it was guilty, guilty, guilty. And you could see I was sitting behind Dennis Spaulding's family and David Carey's mother. And at first, I couldn't see their expressions, but then I just saw their shoulders kind of slump. Saw some tissue coming out, saw some sobbing. I think I heard Dennis Spaulding's father say, "I cannot believe it." They wouldn't comment afterwards, but I don't think they needed to. I think it was right there how shocked they were that when this guilty verdict came down.
So, Susan Campbell, you live in this community. We've talked to you about this story before. I guess I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of a sense of what East Haven is feeling like today after this next step in this very long process is finally complete. Is there any sort of a sense of closure? Are people angry about the verdict? Are people still angry about what these folks were convicted of doing?
I think you have people in all those camps. You have people who are relieved that there is a sense of closure. Now we can move on. But I do think there's a fairly large cadre of people who feel like these police officers are innocent and they are out to get one of our guys. And it won't matter how many authority figures say, no, they did it, and they convicted them, that particular group of people will drag their feet until the day they die and say, this is not fair, which is unfortunate.
I want to get Paul Bass's take on this, because I know, Paul, you've been watching this in your online newspaper. The New Haven Independent has been covering this case as well. What does this verdict tell you about this ongoing problem that seems to be just endemic in East Haven, something that has been happening over and over and over again? It seems to be back in the news over and over and over again. Does this verdict tell you anything?
It tells me that it matters who the president of the United States is.
Really?
So I was first covering this during the Malik Jones shooting in the late 90s, where you have a racist police force, systemically dishonest and racist, and state prosecutors who would never do anything about it. So that nobody, if you live in New Haven, you know everyone has been bothered by the police there. You've seen them lie about incidents. In the Malik Jones case, where an officer chased a black man into New Haven and shot him dead when the man was unarmed, and he lied about it, the reasons. And the prosecutors didn't prosecute him because they felt there wasn't enough legal standard to prosecute the cop, even though he misbehaved. Under George Bush, the U.S. Department of Justice had a policy of not prosecuting civil rights cases. When President Obama was elected, Eric Holder had a policy of aggressively prosecuting civil rights cases. The reason you need the federal government on civil rights, whether it's the Deep South or East Haven, Connecticut, is not because the people are evil there. In fact, the people of East Haven elected, voted for President Obama both times. I mean, there's a misconception that it's a racist town. It's not a racist town. But they had a problem with systemic racism in their police department that was always excused. And it took the federal government to come in there in the 21st century the way it took the federal government to go in the Deep South in the 20th century. And if you read this, to me, the turning point was the civil litigation. When Eric Holder's people came to town and described what happened when they tried to investigate that police force and how they did not feel safe riding around. They were threatened by East Haven police officers. The head of the department and the unions were telling officers not to cooperate with law enforcement from the federal government. The only reason those guys were found guilty yesterday is because we elected a president who was committed to civil rights. The only reason we got progress after decades of outright racism and violent behavior and lying by police is because it took the federal government to come in.
So, Evan, from what Paul's saying here, you have essentially a town which is made up of people who aren't racist, a problem in a police force which seemingly has been on one level or another for quite some time. You have already said people in the courtroom are surprised. I think Susan has already said that there's a lot of people in the town who are surprised that the police would actually be convicted here. So what exactly happens next with East Haven? You've got a mayor who at times has been fully supportive of what his police force is doing. In your newspaper, I just read that he said that their actions were disgusting. What exactly happens next in this town?
Well, I wanted to backtrack because what Paul mentioned is really interesting. The U.S. Department of Justice. After all that, I know they came in there, but you still had to have a jury. You still had to have 12 people agree that these officers were guilty. That's not an easy task. And I feel like one of the things as a society where we're at right now is the defense attorneys did their best to try to cloud the issue of immigration. And I think a lot of these people, maybe 10 years ago, we weren't there yet, but now we're kind of beyond that. And these jurors thought to themselves, well, that's not the issue. The issue is how these people were treated. But to answer your question, Mayor Maturo came into the New Haven Register yesterday, and he spoke with us for 2 hours. This was the first time he's really ever come out and called out his officers for essentially what they were accused of doing. And we asked him, we're like, after all this time, why? And he said, well, I didn't want to go and accuse them until they, innocent until proven guilty. And so that was pretty much the cut and dry of it.
Susan Campbell, so now the mayor, after saying some incredibly unfortunate things over the course of the last several years, which we don't necessarily need to go into, but he's known as Taco Joe for a reason. Now he comes to the Register and says, yeah, what these guys did is disgusting. I mean, as a resident of town, what does this say to you now?
This says to me that Mayor Maturo is running for re-election, and the election's not very far from now. And what East Haven needs, in my view as a resident, is some really radical leadership at the top that I haven't seen thus far. Because when you have a reputation of being a racist town, earned or otherwise, it's like losing your virginity. It's very hard to get back a good reputation. And I think what East Haven's going to have to do is more than is to do more than what's been done so far.
I just want to hear a little bit, and this is Deirdre Daly, who's the acting U.S. Attorney for the District of Connecticut, speaking about this verdict with WNPR.
The verdict is a swift and unambiguous confirmation that a jury found that in a series of incidents, these officers violated people's constitutional rights.
And she continues here. Let's hear a little bit more from Deirdre Daly.
I believe the takeaway is that no one's above the law and no one is beneath the law's protection. In this department, there were a series of incidents with a number of different victims. that showed a pattern of use of excessive force and unlawful arrests and seizures.
So, Colin, I'd like to just get your take before we move on here. Do you think that this shows that we're going to see anything different here in East Haven, that, that indeed this swift and an unambiguous confirmation from a jury that Deidre's talking about there, that this actually makes some sort of a change and makes people wake up about what's been going on in this town?
I think the election will say a lot. I mean, and I'd be interested to hear if there's time what the panel thinks about this. Either the election is a referendum on this and on Maturo's leadership. He's indelibly associated with this case, not simply because of the taco comment, but because of the reinstatement of the police chief, who subsequently retired, because of his comments all through this case. There's no way a two-hour conversation that he has with the Register can shake that. And there are, you know, big financial consequences to this, too. In fact, Evan, this summer, did some really good reporting on the way the $2.5 million consent decree for East Haven may spiral up to about $3 million. It costs a lot of money to have these kinds of problems. Those problems are ultimately passed on to the taxpayers. I think what Maturo has done is actually borrow or plan to borrow to cover some of these expenses. But, you know, on the first Tuesday in November, there's either going to be a kind of you and me against the world attitude in East Haven, in which the people of East Haven bond together and support Maturo because they feel unfairly, a segment of the population feels unfairly condemned for this, or they're going to go with Jack Stacy because they want to change. And I don't know if anybody has any way of predicting which of those two things they'll do.
I think everyone in New Haven here wants to jump in. I'll go to Paul Bass first.
I think the definitive election was the primary. General election doesn't matter. I think it shows how politics has moved. You had a cop who was involved in the Malik Jones case in the cover-up, running as a Democratic candidate for mayor with a right-wing platform to basically defend that last bastion of crooked, racist, violent cop. He lost in a primary to a nobody using dirty tactics that didn't work. The fact that Maturo has moved on means the town has moved on. It'll be hard for Maturo to lose given the realities of politics of the town. Maturo basically understands his town. And I think the significance is what you watch where politicians who survive move. That's more important than where people cast a vote in general elections. So I think when you saw Gary DePalma, the ex-cop, lose that nasty Democratic primary, you saw a town moving on.
Susan?
I just wanted to add one thing, and I don't have a crystal ball, but there, East Haven has lost so much more money than besides what they have to pay, in that when you have a bad reputation, businesses don't come to your town. When you have a bad reputation, people don't move to your town. There's a financial disincentive from being a yahoo, and I really wish people would remember that.
Well, and just I think it's really important. We've had this conversation ever since this case broke a number of times on air, and it is unfortunate because what ends up happening is your town, and in Connecticut, you know, town borders mean a lot.
They do.
It gets a reputation that is completely unfair, but also in some ways fair because of what has happened with the police force and what's happened in the mayor's office. I mean, I asked Colin this, but does your town get past this election or not? This is something that literally sticks with the people of East Haven for some time, doesn't it?
It does. I will say that I live on the most diverse street I've ever lived on in my life, Hughes Street in East Haven, and I'm happy to be there, and it works. And I don't think that's an unusual street in East Haven. But as a town, I think, as I said, there has to be some heroic measures taken, some publicly heroic measures taken, besides buying a piece of pastry at Goody's Bakery, besides a Latino Expo, business expo. That is not enough.
Evan, a last word on this?
I will just say that during that interview yesterday, Mayor Maturo said something very true. And he said, in every other town in Connecticut, I wouldn't get elected dog catcher. And he's absolutely right. But in East Haven, who knows what's going to happen?
We're so proud.
That should go on a campaign poster. So anyway, we'll move on from that into another story that happened on Monday afternoon. This one out of Yukon, where attorney Gloria Allred announced that seven women who were alleged victims of sexual assault filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. One of the women was Kylie Angel. She's a recent graduate and discussed how her attacker was expelled from the university.
2 weeks later, I was eating in a dining hall when the perpetrator sat down next to me and threateningly grazed my elbow in an act of obvious defiance. I was then met by heckling from his friend, who shouted at me, that the perpetrator was back.
And this is one of the stories that we heard yesterday. Colin McEnroe, we've been following not only this story coming out of UConn, but a number of cases of sexual violence on campus around the state over the course of the last couple years. And I know that you've spoken with and had on your program one of the young women who actually made this statement the other day. Are you surprised at all by this coming out of UConn? And what are you thinking about today around this these allegations?
I guess what I'm thinking about today is a question that I asked last May when I was first in touch with Carolyn Luby, who's one of the lead plaintiffs in this case. At that time, in a column I wrote, would you send a bookish, non-sports-oriented freshman to UConn next fall? And because Carolyn Luby, in her original open letter to President Herbst, was kind of asking that question. She was sort of saying, this seems to be increasingly a campus culture that exalts sports aggression, testosterone, jock culture. She wasn't comfortable with the new logo. To her, that was symbolic of a lot of other underlying issues. And you know, it's each one of these seven complaints needs to be and deserves to be evaluated on its own merits and on its own facts. But taken together, it does raise that question. Is this increasingly an institution that favors a certain kind of mentality, is a more comfortable place to be if you're a certain kind of person and a less comfortable place to be if you're another kind of person? And I sense in talking to UConn people, in emailing back and forth with them and reading some of the coverage, one of the things a lot of women in particular at UConn are waiting to hear is some kind of moral humanistic language from President Susan Herbst. What they tend to get are these very corporate-sounding responses to this. And what Carolyn Luby was looking for last May, and I think what people on campus right now, some of them anyway, are looking for, is for President Herbst to say something that sounds more like a college president and less like a CEO of a somewhat besieged corporation.
I know that at the time that Carolyn Luby wrote this open letter, President Herbst called the letter, if I have this right, inappropriate. And I know that there were a lot of people on that campus, Colin, who said some things to Carolyn Luby. She said she got some threats. Do you think that maybe because of that backlash over the course of the last year or so, that helped to prompt these women to make this case right now? Essentially, it seemed as though that was a warning shot in a way to the university. Hey, you should really pay attention to this stuff. And it seems that from a lot of the student body to the administration, people just didn't take it seriously. And now maybe they have to.
Well, I think we need to fully lay out that Carolyn Luby, when she did this, it went viral. It went national. It was Rush Limbaugh material. She was pounded. She took a sort of Sandra Fluke kind of pounding on the internet and in the national press. And at no point did Susan Herbst really kind of jump in there and protect her student from that. She kind of left her twisting slowly in the wind. Now, one of the questions that's not answered yet is, how did Gloria Allred come to show up at UConn? But my uninformed guess is that, yeah, this turned into a national story. It turned into the kind of story that leads to the kind of day that UConn had 2 days ago. And certainly if you wanted to set the stage to have Gloria Allred show up on your campus for a seven plaintiff Title IX complaint, yeah, handle Karen Luby exactly the way you did last May.
Susan Campbell, I'd love to get your thoughts.
I was thinking as Colin was talking that the Georgetown University president, I believe, sent a campus-wide email supporting Sandra Fluke when Rush Limbaugh weighed in with his idiocy. And I second what Colin said. They're waiting for Susan Herbst. When you have a police official telling a young woman who says she's been raped that young women have to stop spreading their legs like peanut butter, he is not describing rape. He's describing consensual sex. In my mind, it's not rape. And that shows to me, and that's one incident, but also the skit that was on the campus television station. If you haven't seen it, it's on Huffington Post, and it's disgusting. And they took it down. They've apologized. But there's too many of those incidences that have happened that haven't been answered by anything other than. And I think Susan Herbst is the CEO of a beleaguered corporation. She's not treating this like a school. There are so many teachable moments in these things, and they've all been put by the wayside while the university ducks and covers.
And this happened on the campus of Yale University not so very long ago, a major complaint against the university alleging some of these same things. Yale and UConn, very different places, though, Paul.
You know, since you can watch both, I keep hearing this theme about we want our leaders to speak and show leadership, which, like in East Haven case, I think reverses the way that change really happens. People speak, but I see the point here. I think in the modern, both corporatized education age and lawsuit age, people who run major institutions, educational institutions, feel hesitant to speak out because of who's going to sue whom. Now, in Yale, they had these cases where a professor had been having inappropriate sexual contact, where there had been frats that were harassing women, and the U.S. Department of Education actually cited Yale for outcome. So Yale seriously tried to wrestle with this. They started showing scenarios. They started speaking out the way we're talking about here, what kind of interactions aren't okay, but they, because of lawsuits, they wouldn't give specifics of the cases. So I think that I agree with this idea we need our leaders to speak out more and be human beings rather than corporate lawsuit-averse automatons, but they are operating under extreme pressure in these cases that I think is sometimes holding them back.
We're talking with Paul Bass of the New Haven Independent, Susan, who is Communications and Development Director at the Partnership for Strong Communities, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Evan Lips, who's a reporter for the New Haven Register. We're broadcasting The Wheelhouse today from New Haven. We'll take some of your calls at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the big stories of the week here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, and so that means it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're broadcasting today from WNPR's New Haven studios. We're happy to be here and getting to see in person Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, Susan Campbell from the Partnership for Strong Communities, Evan Lips, who's a reporter from the New Haven Register. Colin McEnroe is with us up in the Hartford studios today. We want to talk a little bit about a big event that happened in New Haven last night that Paul was moderating. It was the big mayoral debate, the first and last one before the election. And this is Tony Harp versus Justin Elicker. Of course, they were both Democrats. Elicker lost in the primary, and now he's taking on Tony Harp in this general election. What was the scene like last night, Paul?
It was fun because, you know, we had a primary first because this is the first time in 20 years we have an open seat for mayor. We had a mayor for 20 years who ruled the city. He's retiring. So we had 15 debates in the primary, seven candidates down to four. It was wild, and it was fun. And it was very open, positive. General election's been a different story. It's a one-on-one, and there was only one major public debate. So hundreds of people came out. It was raucous, but I think controlled and fun, and it was an interesting evening.
So what were the major issues last night, and where were the two candidates trying to get one up on each other?
What was at stake is what kind of experience and approach is needed to govern a city in the 21st century. And you have two very different constituencies, two very different approaches. So what was at stake for Justin Elicker, who has been in New Haven 6 years, but an alderman for four, was to say that a new kind of politics and approach is needed, and that experience doesn't mean having been in government a long time. What was at stake for Tony Harp, who has been a state senator for 21 years, running to be the first black female mayor in the city, and has been here since the 70s, is to say that was to prove that someone who's been around longer and has worked with three governors and been the head of an appropriation committee vetting a $40 billion budget knows better how to really make a city run. That's what was at stake. And a lot was at stake for Elicker because it's going to be hard for him to win, and he needed some knockouts.
When you say knows better how to make a city run, it seems from not only reading some of the accounts of last night's debate, but in just reading your reporting and the Register's reporting on this campaign overall, is that a lot of the case that Tony Harp is making is that the way you make a city run is to know how to go to Hartford and work with people there. I guess I'm wondering how you feel that plays in the city of New Haven. I'll ask you first. I'll ask Evan and Susan as well to chime in on this. But I think it's a really interesting case that she's making, that one of the biggest things she's bringing is a connection to what I think a lot of us think of as kind of a broken system in Hartford of trying to write laws and
well,
send money to the cities.
Well, her point there is that half of our $500 million budget comes from Hartford. So that you would immediately have to lay off tons of teachers, or you won't be able to build a development project if you can't get Harvard to fund it. But I actually think the bigger question was, who knows New Haven? Because New Haven is changing. So the base Elicker has is people who have moved into basically downtown in two neighborhoods who are distrustful of government. They prefer non-governmental organizations. They care a lot about bicycles and pedestrians and friendly streets. They care about data-driven policy. Whereas HARP is very much connected to people who have been around here for a long time who believe that change or good government comes through the messy democratic process of organizing unions, government committees, one-on-one conversations and human anecdote. And I think that is the clash of the visions and the approaches that we've seen in the city.
Hey, Evan, what do you think is at stake here? What do you think this election is really about?
Well, John, it's tough for me to comment because my head's been in East Haven for like 2 months. But I am a New Haven resident.
Yeah.
And I have met briefly both of the candidates, and I feel like they couldn't be more different, which I think presents voters with a unique opportunity. One of the things I was struck by with Mr. Elicker is his way of speaking and his tenacity, and that he's a younger guy and a guy who, kind of like me, isn't from New Haven. It kind of came here as another, you know, a Connecticut person, but a person who valued the cultural things that he could find in this city, which I think attracts so many of us. So there's that, and then there's Tony Harp, who I've met before and who is, you know, a legend in Connecticut as far as state politics go for a long time. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Do we want someone from Hartford and someone who's in that network, or do we want to go with something else?
See, I would disagree about that Hartford network. I think the issue is which New Haven are they connected to? Yeah. Tony Harp is the most popular politician in New Haven, the one that John DeStefano was scared of running against because of her ties to groups in the city, especially non-for-profit groups. Whereas there is this new constituency that pushes for the safe street legislations, bicycles, data-driven charter reform, that has become a real presence in the city and is driving the policy agenda, who don't even remember who Tony Harp was or never met her, but relate like you do to Justin Elicker, because he's the young new white guy who knows all this stuff. And that's what I think the real...
Susan, you want to jump in?
Only to say that, so maybe this is New Haven's referendum, but I live in East Haven and we have a dog catcher, so I can't really
where it's going. Colin, do you think, I'm drawing the wrong conclusions here about this. I guess watching this as an outsider, I keep hearing Tony Harp talk about these Hartford connections. Paul's saying, you know, she's also, of course, a very popular politician in New Haven. What do you see from where you're sitting in Hartford watching New Haven?
First of all, I think the two things that you and Paul are exploring are not mutually exclusive. I mean, I think probably there are both issues in the campaign. I thought there were some interesting moments in the debate last night, and I'd love to have Paul talk a little bit more about them. To Paul's point, there was a point in which I think Paul was the one who asked Elicker why he didn't get more Black and Latino votes, why he doesn't seem to speak to that community very well. And it's I think it probably is a make or break kind of question. I think it's pretty difficult in the changing New Haven picture. I think it's difficult for a white candidate who can't speak, who hasn't successfully spoken, if that's the case, to minority voters to win an election like that. I think it's that's a very tough thing to contemplate unless he's managed to adjust the frequency of his dog whistle so he's speaking to those groups better. Paul, also, one point I would mention last night was, and it's hard to tell in written coverage how something like this plays, but at one point it appeared as though Harp actually kind of taunted Elicker a little bit about like what committees would, you know, some bill have to go through, and you don't know which committees it goes through, and it almost seemed a little bit like Al Gore saying to George Bush, you don't know what Dingell Norwood is, which can be obnoxious.
That's so funny, because that, to me, being in the room, I felt that was the turning point of the whole debate, because all night Harp's point was that you've been here for a couple of years as an alderman, but you don't know how to get something done. You have this idea that you need Hartford needs to change something. What committee would you go to? And Elicker couldn't answer the question. In terms of the racial issue, it is interesting because Elicker actually, when he has worked with people in the minority community campaigned, he gets a very positive response. Elicker is a strong person connecting one-on-one, whereas because Hart's been in Hartford, there is a whole new generation of New Haveners who's never met her. And I've seen Elicker get strong support for individual people of color he's dealt with on issues like dirt bikes or arts or safe streets. But there is a larger problem is that, you know, Harp is very well known in the minority community, would be the first black woman. There's a lot of pride that especially African-American women are taking. It's become almost like a cause in New Haven, because here you have someone who is the most experienced politician in town and popular running to become the first black female mayor. So then that's a cause. But Collins also worked in advance, which is that Elicker, not because he encourages this is not who Elicker is, but he does get the votes on the East Shore and in Westville of people who just can't stand the idea of a black female mayor. Like, even more so than in East Haven, that's not the politics of the future. But on the East Shore, Harp even tried some scare tactics against Elicker right before the primary, in the days before. She actually made up this idea that he was going to close their firehouse, which he never said. And even that didn't work. That would normally, in the usual, like, nasty campaign, that would roll you up the votes. But in East Shore, some of these people are even willing to get rid of their fire engine and let their house burn down rather than have a black woman become the mayor. So the dynamic works both ways. But in New Haven, obviously, it's more in Harp's favor.
But that's a really – I mean, so go ahead, Colin.
Well, yeah, I have one more question for Paul, mainly because I enjoy Paul's tone of voice when he talks about these things. But, Paul, last night during the debate, you brought up two figures from the past to whom the Harp campaign appears to be connected, two figures who are associated with allegations of corruption in the past. This was sort of news to me. I mean, I hadn't really read this whole...
Not just allegations.
Yeah, no, not just allegations. This is why I'm asking you. And this is why I enjoy your tone of voice. I like hearing you talk about corruption in New Haven. So just sketch this out for us a little bit more. Obviously, Harp has already been taking some knocks over her husband and son company and their performances as tax scofflaws and city landlords. This was kind of news to me. Sketch this out a little bit more for us.
Yeah, this was Justin Elker's big missed opportunity last night. And if he doesn't become the mayor, it's because he blew this one. All right? Because Tony Harp's not corrupt. It's nothing like that. But there were a couple of people. New Haven had a city for sale sign on its city hall. And it took 8 years to get John DeStefano. It took the FBI. It took even the Register eventually even getting on the act, pushing him to get a way of doing business out of City Hall and people who are personally profiting from decisions they were making in government over and over again with outrageous conflicts of interest. 10 years later, she's running for mayor, and they're all seeing their way back in, and they come in. At the same time, she's raising money in a way that got John DeStefano a lot of trouble. City was losing a lot of money on workman's comp fraud. They kick out the doctors who were faking the notes, and then they immediately give a lot of money to Tony Harp to run for mayor, pay for play, right? So that's what Elicker wants to talk about. Instead, he's beating her up about how many bathrooms in her house and her dead husband's tax bill, which to his people who are excited about his campaign, the 35% he has in the poll right now, they're all excited about that, but they're voting for him anyway. Otherwise, he's looked like this privileged white guy from Decatur who also grew up rich, is beating up this woman who came out of poverty because her dead husband was kind of in trouble all the time and not paying his bills, and is not getting a single vote, while he's letting pass the idea that these people who have been waiting for 10 years to put a city for sale sign back on City Hall are coming back in. And in the debate last night, she welcomed them. She said, I'm the mayor for everybody. I believe in redemption, without admitting there was anything to be redeemed for.
And he passes up an opportunity to run against Tony Harp by not actually running against Tony Harp, actually running against the old politics that everyone hates.
And he said the words. But here's where public financing came in.
Yeah.
In the early DeStefano era, that was all about how you raised the money and who did it. And that's happening again. And she's not running public financing. She criticizes him for taking public financing when money's tight. And there was this opportunity to say, whether it's workman's fraud or the kind of deals those guys did to enrich themselves, here's a case where just spending a little money on public financing could save us millions. And he didn't explain that. He didn't present himself as someone who – and this fed into Tony's part, which is that he really didn't show that he understands how government works. Instead, he was looking like an old politician who beats up a black woman for being as rich as he was.
And so you say, before we move on, 35% in the polls. I mean, is there any chance at all that Justin Elicker
there
is the
mayor? There is a chance. The election is not over, but a lot has to – everything has to go his way. All these – what we're not talking about is the labor vote-pulling operation that elected Dan Malloy is behind Tony Harp. And they really have done a lot of grassroots organizing, but they're candidates for the Board of Aldermen. None of them have opponents in general election. So the question is going to be, how hard are they going to work as usual to pull out that vote? The betting money, he has to convince every single undecided voter to come to the polls and that he represents something new and different. And, well, it's a long shot, but it's not out of the question.
We're talking about the news of the week on The Wheelhouse here on WNPR's Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. That's Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent. We're going to take a couple quick phone calls here, 860-275-7266, about some of the stories we've been talking about. John's in Kensington. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Yes, I just want to thank you for your topics today, but also to encourage you to keep the pressure on about UConn. It's, you know, the wasteful spending up there, the culture that they have had around that sports program. I have a friend that was a student there. She was tutoring a basketball player. She couldn't get paid because he couldn't initial her time card because he didn't know what his initials were. And I just think that that is horrible. I think coaches are selling tickets, and I think you guys got to keep the pressure on. It's appalling what these women, the stories that they told. And as a taxpayer who helped run that place, I just could scream.
John, thank you very much. And Colin, before we take a break here, you know, I think John's hitting on a lot of the things you've been writing about, not just about, you know, these allegations that are coming out the other day, but about the cultural change at the University of Connecticut. And John's hitting on a series of things that you have been writing about for quite some time now.
Yeah, you know, I was looking today at an email that Susan Herbst sent to an alumnus who has sort of congratulated her for dealing with the problem of spring break, which I think she did address pretty effectively. But at one point, she said in the email that she took a lot of grief from the students. There were students angry about their inability to party in the old way, 8,000 people drinking in a parking lot. Then she said, but it's not up to the hate speech level of the stuff we get on the sports blogs, so that's good. You know, it was just a little offhand comment in an email, but it suggests to me that Susan Herbst understands the kind of aggressive, verbally aggressive, and sometimes physically aggressive culture that Carolyn Luby was complaining about, that this caller is alluding to. She knows it's there. It just doesn't seem as though she's addressing it in any kind of forceful and, as I said before, humanistic way.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll get to some of the other stories that are happening this week in New Haven, including an end to one-way streets. We'll also take a look at some new leaks in the Sandy Hook case. Still not an official police report, but a lot more information coming out in the Hartford Courant and other places. We're talking with Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, Susan Campbell from the Partnership for Strong Communities, Evan Lips from the New Haven Register, and with you at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, a big conversation about democracy after the shutdown. We'll talk to a UConn philosophy professor who says we're in a dangerous political moment, and a Wesleyan economist who thinks there's a lot we can learn from past economic policy disasters. You can join our conversation tomorrow here on Where We Live. You can also always join us online at WNPR.org. Today, it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, which we do every Wednesday. We're usually in Hartford, though. Today, we're broadcasting from New Haven. Joining us in the New Haven studio, Paul Bass, Susan Campbell, and Evan Lips. Joining us from Hartford today is Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. What's on your show today, Colin?
We are gathering together not only the new state troubadour. Several other states have state troubadours, but I love the fact that Connecticut has one. But we will have three former state troubadours as well, and we're all going to sing together the Connecticut State Tourism Song. Not really.
Oh, my God. I would really like to hear that. So please tune in at 1 o'clock for the Colin McEnroe Show. While the public waits for the official report of what happened on December 14th, 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary School, the Hartford Courant has reported some new leaks in this story. This story essentially reads like a straightforward narrative. It adds some depth to some of the things we already know. But essentially, it's just a little bit more detail as we await for this public report. Colin, I'll ask you first. What did you take away from these new revelations, some of which seem substantive, some of which less substantive, coming out about what we know about the shooter in this case and what we know about any of the response to this case? Are we learning something new? Is this just more delaying until we finally get this police report that was supposed to be delivered in June and now still isn't here?
You know, I think the delaying is more the issue than the substance of what came out this time. And, you know, we really sort of have delay on three fronts now. We have the unusual action taken by the legislature in the waning hours of the last session, where they passed a law excluding all homicide photos from the FOI law as a way of protecting the sensibilities of Newtown survivors. We have their fight now, the town's fight with the FOI commission. It's a separate fight on the 911 calls. The FOI commission has now ruled that those are FOIable. The town has some time to consider and appeal this. And then we just have the slowness of the Sudensky report, the report that was supposed to come out last March. It's delayed and delayed and delayed. And what happens in a situation like this is the wackos who have all kinds of weird conspiracy theories of Newtown have a petri dish in which to breed. I mean, there's just you can almost forgive them for some of their insanity. And meanwhile, rational people are starting to look at this case and say, you know, there's something wrong here. There's some reason why there are stalling issues on so many different fronts. There's some kind of information that is unpalatable that somebody doesn't want us to know. And I think the last thing I'd say is the saddest thing about this is it takes Newtown from a tragedy that elicited, I think, from people a sense of pure sorrow, and it's slowly dragging it down to the level of a kind of a grade B political fiasco. And I think that's sad, too. I mean, this should have been dealt with in such a different way.
Susan Campbell, as we continue to wait for this report, it seems that everything Colin says is absolutely right. Anything that you would want to draw as a conclusion, anything that you would want to make up along the course of the last year, you would have plenty of time to because of this delay in this official police report. And I think when I was reading this current story over the course of the last weekend, what it struck me as was that somebody had actually leaked the police report, and I just saw fact pattern after fact pattern after fact pattern. We may not ever know all that much more than we already know. Why this delay and why? How exactly do you think that this is going to affect the people of Newtown, as Colin's saying, and the rest of us as we sort of try to get some closure on this as we approach this one-year anniversary?
I'm not sure the families will ever have closure, and I cannot imagine what it's like to read another story where there's details that maybe you didn't know or maybe you knew but was the facts weren't public. My understanding is that this kind of delay is common when there's a tragedy like this, when there's multiple homicides. I don't know enough about the subsequent weeks after the Aurora shooting, the theater shootings, or Columbine, but it did take a long time. And I'm not excusing anyone. I don't, speaking as, you know, I'm still have enough journalist blood in my veins, I'm surprised at what's being leaked. I'm trying to figure out why these facts leaked over something else. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The story from the Current of this weekend, it was a good story, but there was no rhyme or reason to what was being leaked, and I don't understand.
Yeah, Paul Bass, as I was reading it through, it seemed to me as though it almost was highlights of a final police report, and that's all it was. There wasn't really a story being told. There wasn't any advantage being given by this information being leaked.
Yeah, and that's what's made me try to reassess what I think about freedom of information law since Newtown. That we've all felt it locally about the police departments having new rules to what they release. So yeah, the state police have always been thugs when it comes to never releasing information, and it's counterproductive, and it's the legislature's overstepping based on Newtown to restrict information. But I had an experience in New Haven based on this that made me reconsider about why we want articles. I found that current story boring. I could care less what was on the guy's wall. It was trivial. And then recently in New Haven, there was a man who called 911 after he'd been stabbed to death, I think, 48 times. And he couldn't give good information on the phone. And then they couldn't find him that night. And the next morning, they found him dead. They could have maybe saved his life if they found him. So I FOI'd, put a freedom of information request to hear the 911 tape. And the department had no problem releasing it because the 911 operator did not mess up. It became an interesting look at how you deal with this. But because of Newtown and the sensitivity of the family, they felt that under the law they could not let people hear, the public. I wanted to put it on our website, what that man's voice was like, that the family would feel bad. So I said, forget it. This is terrible. You guys are being thugs after Newtown. I'm repealing this one. But then they went and talked to the family, and the family was so happy that that voice wasn't going to be heard. And they played the tape for me and let me write about it. And at first I thought, like any journalist, the public needs to know. They need to hear that tape. And it's not going to have the same impact. But in the end, I think the police department was right. I did not challenge it because there was still a compelling story to read. I know it's a little antediluvian, the idea that you read it instead of hear it. And that you did have the public policies come out of, nothing was hidden. But I felt better that we didn't increase the family's pain. So ultimately, I still think policy-wise, the state's wrong. that they shouldn't weaken FOI this way. But maybe journalists and local police maybe to work together without the weaknesses of the law to be more sensitive to the families and see what's important.
And Colin, that's the argument that actually our company and several other journalism organizations made at this panel hearing, this task force that's been arranged to take a look at these FOI laws. This last week, we had a statement read into the public record that essentially said, we as journalists will use this information properly and sensitively, but we can't be completely and utterly shielded from it. Does what Paul's saying make some sense to you from the standpoint of what we should see and what we should release to the public?
Well, what Paul says always makes sense to me. I think, you know, the committee that's good. I mean, first of all, of course, we know that the legislature did this backwards. They passed a law abridging the Freedom of Information Act. Now they're having public hearings with this special super committee on whether they did the right thing or not. Well, you're supposed to do it the other way around. You're supposed to have the public hearings, then pass the law. And, you know, they're having that conversation. And so one of the major detractors of the press there on that committee that's considering the Newtown-based change in the FOI law, Deborah Lee Hovey, who represents Newtown among her towns, she basically talks about the less attractive side of the press. She says, look, I saw what the press did. She's not talking about Paul Bass. She's not talking about NPR. She's talking about, you know, big networks and out-of-state press entities that came into Newtown and made people's lives miserable and did garish coverage. And to me, that's an interesting question, you know, how the press behaves. But there will always be bad behaviors. There will always be bad actors within the press. There will always be people who behave less thoughtfully and less honorably than Paul Bass. The question is, are we going to change our attitudes towards public access to information about a crime based on the worst possible behavior of the press? My argument would be no. I just quickly would add one thing. I was on a panel about FOI last night, so it's fresh in my mind. And former Congressman Rob Simmons was on, and he made a really interesting point. He said, you know, would you build a new school, a new Sandy Hook school, without knowing the full story, without having all of the information about this previous event? Would you build any new school in the state of Connecticut without knowing everything there was to know about police response, about how the school handled this? How all the information that we can't get our hands on right now is germane to a whole series of questions. That was one I hadn't really thought about until Rob brought it up.
Yeah, germane to how we're going to spend a whole lot of money. Evan, I know you want to jump in. Just a quick last thought on this.
Yeah, a quick last thought is that usually when, you know, in my experience, when police and state police won't release details or whatever, it's because they want to convict somebody. But in this case, there's nobody to convict. There's no trial. There's no – it's not going to hurt anything. Maybe it'll just hurt themselves. I don't know.
We're going to move on in just the last couple minutes here because we're in New Haven and we've been talking about some important New Haven issues. We love to talk about urban planning. We love to talk on our program. And I have to ask you, Paul, I see this in your paper in the New Haven Independent. One-way streets may be changed around in New Haven. One-way streets are how we get around New Haven. Now, what are they doing?
Here's the idea, and I think it comes under the umbrella of new urbanism. 1950s and 60s, people were moving out of New Haven. We thought our salvation was going to be make it easy to drive in and out so people from suburbs could quickly spend their money and leave. That didn't work. So we have all these one-way streets that are crazy downtown so you can zip through. Now new urbanism is the prevailing philosophy, which is that make the streets two-way, make it easier to slower traffic, walk and bike on it more easily. They're talking about maybe changing them back. The debate is more complicated in detail. I have a feeling we don't have time to go into that.
I don't think we have a whole lot of time. How much time do we have? We have about 1 minute left, which is probably just enough time to say, is this going to be all the streets that are one-way are going to be changed?
Absolutely not, because it's actually more complicated. Sometimes one-way streets make sense, sometimes they don't, and we're going to figure that out in New Haven because it's always interesting in New Haven.
It is. It should be in a billboard when you come into town. That's why we're here today. It is always interesting in New Haven. Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent helps to keep it interesting. Paul, great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks also to Susan Campbell. She is our East Haven correspondent, but she also is the Communications and Development Director at the Partnership for Strong Communities. Always great to see you, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you. Go Cards.
And yeah, that's right. World Series tonight. Go Red Sox. Evan Lipps, reporter from the New Haven Register. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Colin McEnroe is always the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Thanks, Colin.
Paul Bass for mayor. Susan Campbell for president of UConn.
our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Katie Solarski. Thanks to Lori Mack today. This is Where We Live.